In any case, the formation of the first stars is a very central problem in many respects in astrophysics. It is absolutely crucial to the determining the epoch of reionization. The formation of the elements and the history of the formation of the elements is critical. Is it possible, for example, to find regions in the intergalactic medium which are not already enriched by these heavy elements? The infrared background is may be produced by these stars. And we also have the formation of the first stellar mass black holes. In fact, as I think Stan will go into in much more detail in the next talk, the actual masses of these first stars is critical in determining whether or not you form black holes and the nature of the black holes. It's possible that these first stars could actually produce gamma ray bursts. That's really not known at this time. If that's true, it's going to really open up an incredible opportunity for astronomy and astrophysics, because you'll be able to not only learn direct information about the nature of these first stars, but also study the entire line of sight between us and these very high redshift objects. And then, of course, these star formation has importance for the formation of active galactic nuclei. Some of the first stars may have been in globular clusters, and they determine the evolution of galaxies. Now, it's believed that the first stars were high-mass stars, and I'll discuss this a little bit more during the main body of the talk, but I just wanted to bring that up now, that because the primordial gas is composed primarily of hydrogen and helium with no metals, then the can't cool below about a couple hundred Kelvin, and that means that the genes mass is of order, say, 500 solar masses for typical conditions. Simulations, which I think Tom will talk about more in his talk, indicate that there's no evidence for any fragmentation during the collapse. And so that also then leads to the, having these stars be fairly large. Then the stellar mass is going to determine both the nucleosynthetic yield and whether black hole forms, as Stan will talk about. Now, the massive stars are of fundamental importance throughout the entire history of the universe. So from our point of view here, we're talking about the very first ones, but even today they have many of the same effects. As I've emphasized, they create a lot of the heavy elements. They also energize the interstellar medium of galaxies. And so, in a sense, if you think about it, I'm going to be talking about the formation of the very first stars, and that is going to be a fairly simple problem. If you ask, well, what about the next generation of stars? That's already a much harder problem because of the fact that the first generation stars will have already had an enormous impact on the ambient medium. Subsequently, then, the star formation regulates further star formation and governs the evolution of galaxies. So what I'm going to talk about is first review the initial conditions and the results of numerical simulations, and then talk about an analytic model that Tan and I developed for isentropic collapse, in which we're able to include the effects of rotation, and then see the evolution of the protostellar radius and luminosity, which particularly the evolution of the radius has a very important effect on the feedback. And then I'll talk about the several feedback effects, including first the emission of FUV radiation, then the emission of Lyman alpha radiation, which causes radiation pressure, then photoionization, and finally a photoevaporation of the disk that forms. So how does this star formation differ? Well, I've already indicated that because in the first generation you don't have any metals, it can't cool. Another very important point is, since you don't have these heavy elements, then they can't coagulate together into dust grains. Contemporary massive star formation, the fundamental problem is how you can form the massive star in when you have this dust, which then absorbs the radiation and is driven away from the star as it forms. Here that problem is not present. Similarly, radiatively driven stellar winds are weak or absent for the same reason. There are probably no magnetic fields. This, I would say, is a very big uncertainty as to whether magnetic fields exist. The canonical wisdom is that the magnetic fields we see in galaxies today are a result of dynamo action. And this is obviously a crucial thing to try to determine observationally. Even if you start off with no magnetic field, it may be that in the accretion disk of these sources, you may be able to build up a field. And in fact, Tan and Blackman have argued that you can. Nonetheless, the field may not be organized enough to be able to produce the stellar outflows that we see today. Then finally, this is, I think, one of the most amazing things that the people such as Abel, Brian, and Norman, and also Brahm, Coppi, and Larson realized, was that the initial conditions are simpler. than in contemporary star formation. This is amazing. You'd think we can actually observe the stars forming today. You'd think, well, you know, at least we could figure out what the initial conditions are. But they're extremely complicated. You know, it all has to do with supersonic magnetohydrodynamic turbulence. And so although there's a lot of simulations of what that's like, there's, I think, very little actual physical understanding. Whereas here, we believe that since these initial conditions are set by from the Big Bang, that depending on if you believe you can extrapolate these conditions down to the small scales of individual stars, we actually can predict what those initial conditions are. So very briefly, let me just have an overview of the structure of formation. Remind you that we have recombination at a redshift around 1200. And thereafter, the gene's mass is about constant. And at about the typical mass, in fact, is comparable to the mass of a globular cluster. Now, once you decouple from the radiation, then the temperature starts to drop, and the gene's mass drops also. And then have this nice result from Piero Madao, which shows that the if you look over here at the temperature, so here we have the CMB temperature, the gas temperature decouples and then falls. But once you get reionization, which here he took to occur at a redshift of 10, then the temperature shoots up. And over here we have the gene's mass. So you have it falling down and all of a sudden shooting up to values that are border galactic scales. But for the formation of the first stars, we're back in this region here, where the gene's mass is still low. Then I'm sure Tom is going to talk about this more in his talk, but I just wanted, it's a very important context for my talk. This was the paper that he wrote with Greg Bryant and Mike Norman, and starting at a redshift of 100 and going down to a redshift of 18. And you can see that here are snapshots of the gas density on different scales of 6 kiloparsecs, 600 parsecs, 6 parsecs, and then 0.06 parsecs. And here are similar pictures for the temperature. And you can see the formation of a protostellar core here that's going to eventually form a star. And particularly once the density becomes sufficiently high, you'll get rapid H2 formation, and then it can collapse. In 1D simulations, I should say that it's then difficult to continue these much beyond here, but 1D simulations show that you can go ahead and form a hydrostatic protostar, and it will then suddenly undergo collapse. Now, the problem is that we have a Zeno's paradox here. The time step has to basically follow the characteristic gravitational time step, which goes like 1 over the square root of g rho. So in some work that Klein and I did with Kelly Trulove some years ago on contemporary star formation, we had a density increase of 9 orders of magnitude, which meant that the time step decreased by 4.5 orders of magnitude. In the simulations I just showed you by Abel et al. For primordial star formation, they were able to get a density increase of 17 orders of magnitude, which then caused a time step decrease of 8.5 orders of magnitude. And basically that means that the calculation is going to stop before the formation of the first protostar. And so you really have to go ahead and use an analytic approach if you want to be able to follow things in more than one dimension and see what's going to happen. Now, the initial conditions really depend, as I've indicated, upon the fact that you have trace amounts of molecular hydrogen. And this molecular hydrogen forms as a result of the small amount of ionization that's present. And here's an energy level diagram of H2. And the basic reason why you can't cool off very much is that these energy levels here are separated by a border several hundred Kelvin. And so once you get down there, you cease to be able to cool. By contrast, in the interstellar medium today, we have CO, and the energy levels are separated by only a few degrees. So here is a result from Brahm, Coppi, and Larson, where a plot of the temperature versus the density. And they followed the collapse of gas. And what they found is that there was a gas tended to accumulate here at a density of order 10 to the fourth and a temperature of order a few hundred Kelvin. And the reason is set by this H2, that 10 to the fourth is the critical density of H2, where you can basically, the levels go into LT and the cooling efficiency becomes less. And as I've indicated, the temperature is just set by the energy level structure. Then this partially molecular gas contracts sort of as a adiabatically with an adiabatic index, which is about 1.1. based on these one-dimensional calculations. And so this means that the collapse is about isentropic. In other words, this parameter here, which is related to the entropy, is constant. We have about 1.1. And the turbulence in this collapse is weak. Now, the simulations by Abel et al. Are consistent with the density structure that you expect for this. So if you just let the density go as a power of the radius, then hydrostatic equilibrium implies that this index here is related to the gamma, and it's 2.2. And in fact, if you look at their results, here you're starting off with the density structure at a redshift of 19, and then these are the various time intervals after that. You can see that you get shorter and shorter times, and along here, this is the density power law of about 2.2. So for the collapse of an isentropic sphere, this was actually worked out many years ago by Amasya Heal for supernova calculation, and in the context of contemporary star formation by McLaughlin and Pudrytz. And it's the basis of the turbulent core model that Jonathan Tan and I developed for contemporary massive star formation. Now, in the work that Jonathan and I did for this case, we actually allowed for subsonic inflow, and you then infer that the accretion rate is about, for if the mass of the star is around 100 solar masses, then you're already at more than 3 × 10⁻³ solar masses per year, so that the time scale to form such a massive star is about 30,000 years. And so if you just put up this result here, is the mass of the star, and also we assume that there's a disk that has some of the mass, so we plotted that on this axis. I'm sorry, this is the accretion rate, and this is the that mass that you're getting. So these are the one-dimensional calculations that I referred to previously. This is our model from, that Tan and I got. And this line here is from the simulation of Abel et al. Now, I have to emphasize that this curve here is different than these. These are actually are following what the accretion rate is onto the central star, whereas this is this based on a snapshot at the end of their calculation prior to the formation of a protostellar core. Nonetheless, you see that by the time you get up into this key region of 10 to a few hundred solar masses, that this is definitely in the right ballpark. So rotation, however, is extremely important. What Abel et al. Found was in the outer regions of their collapse that the ratio of the rotational velocity to the capillary velocity was about a half. And so what's going to happen is that you're going to have this gas collapse. But once it actually enters into a supersonic phase of the infall, then the angular momentum will be conserved, and then you can go ahead and calculate what the disk radius is. And in calculating the properties of this, we use the work that Roger Ulrich did many years ago for low-mass stars. So then using this, we can calculate the evolution of the protostellar radius, generalizing the work that Nakano et al. Did. And so here we have a plot of what the stellar radius is as a function of the stellar mass. And so the dashed line here is the photosphere, the solid line is the accretion shock, and this little dashed line down here is the main sequence. So you can see that basically as the star accretes, it builds up until here around 30 solar mass or so, and then it comes back down and joins the main sequence. And here this is at about 100 solar masses. And these squares are comparison with the calculation by Stoller et al. And Omakai and Paula, who actually did detailed numerical calculations. We just have a much simpler model. Now, this case is for the no rotation and for the isothermal case. If we go ahead and ask what happens if we change this from isothermal to the isentropic case, and we've normalized K prime just means using the standard value of the entropy, then there's very little change if you have no rotation. You still get the main feature that you should see here is that you have this enormous photosphere, which is now goes to over 1,000 solar radii. However, as soon as I've put in just a small amount of rotation, instead of having this, remember before it went way up here, now even when this parameter is 0.05, it suddenly gets cut off. And if I go to the canonical value that Abel et al. Found, it completely disappears, and then you see that the photosphere just tracks the accretion shock. So the result then is that the protostar is very large, around 100 times the solar radius until it's older than the Kelvin time. Then it contracts along the main sequence and accretes along the main sequence. And we're going to see in just a few minutes that this behavior of the protostellar radius is absolutely critical to the feedback. because as I mentioned, the feedback is determined by FUV and ionizing radiation production. And if you have a very big photosphere, that means it's cool and you're not getting any of those photons. So what about the evolution of the luminosity? So here we have the luminosity plotted against the stellar mass. Here's the Eddington limit. And this shows the emission from the accretion disk and from the boundary layer. And then you can add in the internal luminosity. And that gives you then the total, which still remains slightly below the Eddington limit, even up at very high masses. And then if you look at the ionizing luminosity, here again I get contribution from the accretion disk and the boundary layer. This is the internal due to the nuclear reactions. Then that's the total for a rotation of half Keplerian. And then if I put in the main sequence, you can see here that the main sequence is much larger at lower masses here because my protostellar radius still hasn't contracted, so I'm at much lower ionizing luminosity. But eventually, these extra contributions from the accretion mean that the ionizing luminosity is somewhat larger than you get just from nuclear reactions. And so there's what happens if you have no rotation and it's really suppressed. And so then we can go on and consider the feedback processes. When does accretion end? So as I mentioned, we're going to talk about four different effects: FUV radiation, Lyman alpha radiation pressure, H2 region, and disk photoevaporation. So FUV radiation destroys this coolant, which is the trace amounts of molecular hydrogen. And it's been realized, in fact, it was, as Abel et al. Pointed out, once you produce this FUV radiation, it's going to destroy the coolant over a very large volume and suppress subsequent star formation. Because the whole, I mentioned that we were able to get down to 200 degrees, and when there I was emphasizing that you couldn't go lower than 200 degrees. Now I want to focus on the other aspect of it, which is that you're actually able to get down to 200 degrees, and that depended upon having this trace amounts of molecular hydrogen, about one part in 1,000. This FUV radiation just annihilates all that H2, and then the characteristic temperature you can cool down to is 10,000 degrees, and then as we saw earlier from that plot, the Jeans mass, instead of being hundreds of solar masses, is goes up to 10 to the 9th solar masses or so. So it's a completely different scale. So now what happens if I already have this gas and I have it in this thing where it's in the process of accreting, and I now turn off my coolant? So now it's going, instead of contracting isothermally, or approximately, actually at gamma 1.1, so it's slightly superthermal, but the it's now going to go from that up to a ratio of specific heats of 5/3. So at first I thought that this was going to be absolutely fatal. Because as soon as you do this, you would then tend to, the gas would rapidly heat up and you would just go to Bondi accretion out of a gas that had this very high temperature. However, it turns out that recently Patuso, Adams, and Myers wrote a paper in which they considered the collapse of gas spheres when you have different polytropic and adiabatic indexes. So let me remind you that what I talked about before, I assumed that the density structure went like P, the pressure went like R to some power, right? And so that's like a polytropic model of a star. And I assumed then that as that gas contracted, that that same relation was maintained. That's given by the adiabatic index. So in other words, the adiabatic and polytropic indexes were the same. They're generally written both by gamma, so it's easy to get them confused. But they are two completely separate concepts. So what they've done is they've now considered what happens when you have one polytropic index and a different adiabatic index. And they showed that, in fact, even for gamma of 5/3, it doesn't make any difference. And you can see that why this is. If you once you get into a regime of supersonic inflow, then the density goes like r to the minus 3/2. And so for gamma 5/3, that's T going like 1 over r. The escape velocity goes like squared goes like 1 over r also. So that means that you have the temperature and the square of the escape velocity are scaling the same way. So if I'm bound to start with, I'm going to be bound to wind up with. However, this is gamma 5/3 is the limit. If you have 5/3 plus epsilon, then you get a different answer. So the conclusion is that having this FUV radiation destroy the coolant does not prevent subsequent accretion onto this initial protostar, but it could have a dramatic effect on the subsequent formation of stars in the region. So what about the Lyman alpha radiation pressure? At the same time that I'm producing this FUV radiation, I'm going to be producing a lot of it will be in Lyman alpha, and I have enormous optical depths. I can have column densities of, say, a gram per square centimeter or something. And so if you remember, if you just think about how many orders of magnitude that is for the optical depth of Lyman alpha, you can have, you know, 10 or 11 orders of magnitude of Lyman alpha. So this is actually a very interesting problem that was worked out a long time ago by Adams, because now when I have my Lyman alpha photon, and there's no dust, so I can't destroy this photon, so it's just wandering around, but it not only diffuses in space, it also diffuses in frequency. So you have a simultaneous diffusion in space and frequency. And I should have then mentioned there was a very nice paper by Neufeld also that we used in deriving this. So if you get the radiation pressure, if you just ask, well, if I have a star, and what kind of radiation pressure is it going to produce? If I absorb some flux F, then the radiation pressure is just F over C. And then the force is just going to be the gradient of that. But the if I have an isotropic Lyman alpha photons, then we showed that here's the Lyman alpha flux over C, but it's multiplied by this factor, which you can see can be almost two orders of magnitude here. If I have a column density of 10 to the 20th, and here's the line width. So this only goes to the 1/3 power. If you get up to 10 to the 23 or so, then you could actually have several hundred. But that means that you can get a very large radiation pressure. And when this radiation pressure is greater than about twice the infall velocity, will actually reverse the flow and blow the gas out. So this shows, here we have the protostellar mass, and here's this rotational parameter, F cap. Remember, that's just the rotational velocity divided by the capillarian velocity. And here, this is the typical value up here, and we actually have a couple of different cases here, but basically at the these higher values, you get values at around 20 or 30 solar masses. Then the Lyman alpha radiation pressure is strong enough to get blowout along the poles. And if you, however, as you go down to lower values of the rotation parameter, this mass where this occurs becomes much larger. Here's 100 and here's 1,000. And that's because primarily because the photosphere is cooler and you're not producing as much Lyman alpha photons. However, because this is rotation, I emphasize this is breakout at the poles. It's not so you're going to kind of blow the caps off, but you don't necessarily blow the other gas out. And we showed that once you form a region where the Lyman alpha photons can escape, then they tend to all be channeled out of that region, and they don't, so their effect becomes much weaker. Okay, so what about photoionization feedback? This was considered in a paper by Omakai and Inatsuka a couple of years ago, and they, and I put in this word perfect here because their model does assume perfect spherical symmetry, and they got a very interesting result. They showed that the star ionizes a significant volume of the accretion flow if you have the star more than a few hundred solar masses, and pointed out that this accretion flow is going to stop when the H2 region expands beyond the characteristic gravitational radius. In other words, when the sound speed of the ionized gas here is comparable to the GM over R, the capillarian velocity, then you're going to be able to stop the accretion and blow it out. And that here's how this radius scales with the mass of the star. It's hundreds of AU. Now, what they showed was that earlier in the last slide, I was talking about line radiation pressure on the gas in Lyman alpha. There's also a continuum radiation pressure, because every time I ionize a hydrogen atom, I'm also transmitting momentum. And you can calculate how fast this happens, because it's just going with the recombination rate. So I can have a gas that is almost 100% ionized, but it's recombining, and every time it recombines, it gets reionized and gets this pressure. And they showed that in this case of perfect spherical symmetry, you get an H2 region that's orders of magnitude, literally more than two orders of magnitude smaller than Rg. And they concluded then that the accretion continued much higher mass, and in particular that H2 regions would not limit the mass of primordial stars to less than 1,000 solar masses. This picture changes completely when you include the effect of rotation. So as I mentioned before, we get a formation of an accretion disk that has a radius of could be several thousand AU at 100 solar masses. And you look at the solution by Ulrich, then the density of the accreting gas inside this disk radius is reduced by about a factor of R over RD. That's because a lot of the gas has already fallen onto the disk. And so that means because this amount of recombination then goes down, in fact goes down like the square of that density, so the H2 region expands from being less than 1 AU in the Lemkin and Inotsuka solution to being more than a couple of hundred AU. And so the condition for this H2 region to exceed this gravitational radius is that at the poles, it's you have the mass greater than of order 100 solar masses, and at, near the disk, it's a little bit bigger, maybe 140. Now, I want to also point out here that this mass now depends on two parameters. It depends on this entropy parameter. Remember that it's just the ratio of the pressure divided by the density to the 1.1 power. And if you remember back to that view graph I showed you from Brahm et al., where they showed what happens to the gas accretion, they had a large blob. And so we took a typical value of the entropy out of that large blob of points. But there is a range of points there, and that's going to cause, you know, a range of different conditions here. But also, it's very sensitive. It goes linearly, or inversely, I should say, with this rotational parameter. So that if this, if I'm rotating somewhat faster than a half, I'm going to get a lower mass, and if I'm rotating slower, I can get a larger mass. So you expect to get a range of masses. So here's then a picture then of the growth of the H2 region. So if you balance the ionizing flux against the recombination infault, so here we have the lines, the flow lines, based on Ulrich's theory. And here you have the size of the H2 region. So here's around, we got up to almost 400 AU here. It's up to almost 800 AU at this time. And if you then plot when this H2 region radius becomes greater than the gravitational radius, here you have it for the along the poles, and here you have it in the equatorial region. So I should say that we've considered these effects separately, so that earlier, remember, I said that we calculated what happened with the Lyman alpha radiation pressure. Here, we're ignoring that effect now. We're just calculating what happens if you have only the ionizing radiation pressure. In reality, the Lyman alpha radiation pressure would have already blown this out, so that this would probably, you would have been able to get the ionizing photons to blow out earlier. But as you recall, the Lyman alpha radiation pressure didn't do anything to the equator, so this is what's really going to set the limit. You see there's a very strong dependence on this rotation parameter, so that here, well, if you get all the way up to 1, then you're actually at less than 100 solar masses, and then you're up a little bit over at half, you're somewhat over 100 solar masses. Okay, thanks. Now, the last process that I want to discuss was the photo evaporation of the disk. And here we're relying on some work that was done by Hollenbach et al. For contemporary massive star formation. And they had two cases. We're assuming now that the stellar wind is weak, because remember that with the very low or negligible metals in the stellar atmosphere here, you don't expect to have a very strong stellar wind. And so you have, they calculated that you have this disk here, and they had ionizing photons coming up here and then scattering down onto the surface of the disk and causing an outflow, and they estimated what this is. I should say that, you know, this is a very nice paper, but the estimate that they made is, I think, necessarily very approximate, and I'm sure it can be substantially improved by detailed numerical simulation. In any case, they were able to estimate that the photo evaporation rate here is around 10 to the minus 4 solar masses per year when you're at 100 solar masses. So if I now imagine, the picture that we have is that we have this H2 region, and it's sort of blown, first it blew out at the poles, then it started blowing out closer to the disk. But in fact, at these very high accretion rates, the disk is actually not very thin. And so it's actually able, the disk is able to block some of the radiation. And we're in the process of trying to calculate that now. We don't actually have a result on that. So I just picked a guess to show how it scales, that we're assuming that the disk is able to, say, shield maybe 20% of the inflow. And that means that, so I wiped out 80% of the gas is ionized and I got blown away, but I still have 20% is able to accrete onto this disk, and so I'm going to ask, if that is true, what mass, when will I have this photo evaporation rate balance the accretion rate? And that turns out to be around a few hundred solar masses. So I think this is something that we will be able to, and we're in the process of improving right now, but it's still going to be contingent upon this photo evaporation rate here, which is uncertain. So to summarize on what the feedback does, as I mentioned, the destruction of the H2 by the FUV does not appear to have any direct effect on the final solar mass. I mean, there's like a 10 or 15% effect, but it's not significant. The Lyman alpha radiation pressure sets the minimum stellar mass at around 30 solar masses. So this is also significant. I think this is a point mentioned by both Abel et al. And also Brahm et al., that because there's no clear feedback effect that can set in low masses about this, this is, provides a lower limit to the mass of the first stars. The photoionization produced by the H2 region sets the limit at around 100 solar masses. Now, if the disk is able to shield some of the gas that is accreting, then you can have to rely on disk photoevaporation to go ahead and get rid of the rest of it. And in that case, you might, if this, you're able to shield 20% of the gas, you might get up to several hundred solar masses. So the conclusions are that, first of all, as was emphasized in these previous works, it's really the convergent initial conditions are set by H2 cooling. And that really, the fact that you have a single set of initial conditions is a great simplification for study of the first stars. The analytic model that we have then, based on isentropic collapse, predicts star formation time is of order 30,000 years at 100 solar masses. And then with the accretion rate plus the semi-analytic model for the protostellar evolution implies that it reaches the main sequence at around 30 solar masses when you include the effects of rotation. And so it is, in fact, our analytic treatment that allowed us to go ahead and include the effect of rotation and disk formation on the complex feedback effects. I should say, I think it'll be a very long time before anyone is able to do the Lyman alpha radiation pressure calculation numerically. And these, since the feedback processes don't set in until around 30 solar masses, the first stars are likely to have a larger mass than that. So that sets a lower limit. And the preliminary results that Tan and I have now suggest that the feedback limits the mass of the first stars to around 100 to 300. As Stan, I think, I don't know exactly what he's going to say, but based on his previous work, I think he's going to tell us this is a very interesting range and dramatic. It, of course, it matters a lot whether it's 100, 200, or 300. But so we're in a very interesting region there. Then the IMF of the first stars, we don't anticipate that there's going to be a power law type IMF, but there will be a distribution, and this distribution is dependent on the distribution of entropy and also on the distribution of the rotation. And then finally, I want to emphasize that this mass range can be tested by observations today, both by looking at very old stars and trying to look at the metallicity that are in those old stars that are nearby, and then by observations of the intergalactic medium at high redshift. Thank you.
You've got a twiddle by the 30, and I just like to point out that it's quite important for nucleosynthesis whether that's 30 or 20 or 15, mm-hmm. because most of the lower mass nucleosynthesis comes from 15 to 25. And so I would guess within the spirit of your discussion that 15 would not be ruled out here.
15, I think, would be difficult because the rate, as you know, if you go back to the estimates that we have, of course, these are estimates of what happens to the photosphere when you're accreting at these very high rates. And it's because of the very high rate of accretion that the photosphere tends to be much larger than the main sequence value. And that's why you tend not to get so much Lyman alpha. On the other hand, I think we're in the very early days of trying to understand what goes on with these first stars. And as you consider more and more physical effects and get, I've been emphasizing the simplicity that we believe is characteristic of these first stars. As time goes on, we'll realize it's probably not as simple as we thought.
Would you like to say anything more on the distribution of the rotation parameter? You showed plots in a range of a factor of 1,000 across that. To what extent will that one day be also calculable, or is it too complicated a process involving the size and the accretion disk?
No, I think that I should say that the number that we took was based on simulations that Tom and his collaborators did. And so I think that it is calculable. One of the tricky things, though, is that it depends, at least in their interpretation, it depended upon the turbulent transfer of angular momentum. And so you can see that that in itself is a complex physical problem. And as you go to higher resolution, if we understand that process better, we'll be able to pin it down better. But by the same token, at least if I understand their conclusion correctly, it's not like I think that you can imagine that there'd be some kind of power law distribution or Y distribution of the rotation of the initial clouds. But because this now contracts by over many decades, and if the transport is primarily due to turbulence, you might imagine that then there is some basic physical principle that's tending to drive you toward a narrow range rather than getting some broad power law. So I was showing you the, if you did have a very low rotation, that you could get a dramatically different result. But I think the existing evidence suggests that it will probably have a much narrower range than the one I showed.
These simulations that you are basing your underlying setup on do not obviously include MHP, and especially given the fact that the ionization in the ionized region extends over a substantial part of the disk, perhaps would you expect the distribution of angular momentum to change significantly due to MRI, for example, operating? And also the launching of the wind might be affected by that, how much mass gets out in along field lines that spread too thin. The second question is, you focused on a single object, but at least if you look at this, massive star forming regions in the present day, often you find several clouds forming in the same region, and dynamical interactions can increase the mass beyond what you would identify with a single object in the first place. In other words, you can have coalescence of various clouds coming together. It will not be smooth accretion, but several clouds joining by dynamical interactions.
Okay, so let me comment on the MHT. As I said, what we've assumed here is we've completely neglected magnetic effects. That assumes that the observed magnetic fields in galaxies today are due to the dynamo and not due to some primordial field. If there is a significant primordial field, then things would be different, as you say, and we plan on looking at that. Once you get down into the scale of the disk, then as I mentioned in this work by Tan and Blackman, they concluded that there was enough time to get a dynamo to build up even from a very weak seed field and generate significant magnetic fields in the disk. And this would then presumably lead to an MRI in the disk. I should say that what we've done here is we've just assumed that once you get into the disk, you'll eventually get into the star. We have not attempted to calculate what the rate of accretion of the gas from the disk to the star is. So we've just assumed that either magnetic effects or gravitational torques. If you get by the time you get to a significantly large disk, as you know, then they, you can get gravitational instabilities, which also transmit angular momentum effectively. So we've just assumed that that operates. If you do have this MRI and this these fields generated by the dynamo, it seems to me this is just based on intuition, not based on any good calculation, that the field is going to be highly tangled. And that's very different than the topology of the fields that existing models for MHT-driven winds use. Whether you talk about an X-type wind like Shu does, which depends upon having a strong stellar field, or you just have a disk wind, which just requires you to have field threading the disk. In either case, you have to have the field stretched out over fairly large scales in order to get that to work. So even if you have a tangled field, it may have a big effect on the accretion rate, and it actually enable us to be self-consistent in assuming that the gas does accrete, but I'm not sure it would have a big win. But I agree, that's really uncertain. We don't really have, even for contemporary star formation, we have models, but we're not sure that the models for these MHD winds are correct. Then on the second question you asked had to do with the clumping. And I think as both Abel et al. Emphasized and Brahm et al. Emphasized, when you're looking at the very first star, you tend to look at the very first clump that forms. There, particularly in the Abel et al. Simulation, they started off with a very large mass. If there had been a bunch of clumps forming at the same time, they would have seen them. But they focused on the first one. As I emphasized, you get these extremely high accretion rates. So we're saying that, once you actually get this first protostellar core forming, which could be a tiny fraction of the solar mass, 30,000 years later, you're already up to 100 solar masses. So you would have, in order to have a substantial interaction with other things, you'd need to have something else happening equally rapidly. But I think that, as I said, to me, this suggests that the very first stars are somewhat simpler. This effect of the interaction is important in contemporary star formation, and is going to be important when you go on to second or third generation star formation.
Is it fair to say that this first star formation is really limited in its description to a single star in the primordial mini halo? Because as soon as one forms, it so transforms the process that this description doesn't apply.
That's right. I think that in the thing that's likely to be the have the largest effect is this FUV radiation is going to go out and just essentially prevent large regions. Then, of course, once the star explodes, and I think Mike and his collaborators have looked at that, you can also have dramatic effects there because you then poison the surrounding medium with metals, and as soon as the metallicity, I think the Avi worked this out, and you get this very tiny amount, like 10 to the minus 3 solar or something, and that all of a sudden switches so that instead of having these very large gene masses, you can now get much smaller gene masses.
Chris, could you talk a little bit more about the lack of fragmentation? I mean, how confident are you that there's not fragmentation in this scenario? I assume that's just because it's all isentropic collapse, there's no pool, and so therefore,
That's right. So, in order to have the subsequent fragmentation, which can certainly happen in contemporary star formation, that generally correlated with or associated with having this very efficient cooling, and here we don't have that. Remember that the characteristic genes mass was hundreds of solar masses. Yeah, it was somewhat superthermal during the collapse.
But it's close to one, so that means that there is cooling because otherwise the temperature would rise as the gas falls. The cooling does operate.
That's right, but you still the over large range you find that the accretion, the inflow is still not highly supersonic, and you do not get conditions like you get in contemporary star formation. One of the places where it is possible that you might get some fragmentation is by the time you form this disk. As I mentioned in response to Avi's question, we have not treated the evolution of the disk and physically. We just assumed that the gas goes in and some fraction stays in the disk and some fraction goes onto the star. Now, there are instabilities that occur there, and it's quite possible that you might get fragmentation in that disk,
but
and that could have an effect.
I mean, if it's true that there is some cooling, then the gene mass is decreasing, and there should be the opportunity for fragmentation.
Yeah.
Or not.
Even then, if you look at looking at conditions of contemporary star formation, you get much of the fragmentation occurs prior to the onset of collapse. Once you have a highly non-homologous collapse, then the fact that you have these large gradients is very effective at suppressing fragmentation. So the fragments that you see in contemporary star formation in these simulations are all based on, they have these shocks running through the gas, and they fragment before they get start to collapse. Once they start to collapse, then there's not that much fragmentation until you get to disk formation. And then it becomes a numerical issue. There are simulations which have been reported which have lots of you've probably seen like those by Matthew Bate and company, which show significant fragmentation of disks, and you generate brown dwarfs, and they get thrown out, and so forth. But it's not at all clear that those calculations are numerically resolved.
A related question: would you think you would form fewer binary stars at this early epoch, or could we use current stars as a guide?
Yeah, because right now there's no evidence that you would form a binary. But I'm going to put in a big caveat there, which is, as I said, that it is contingent upon assuming that you have effective angular momentum transport in the disk. If that's not so effective and you did form and the disk were able to fragment, then you might get a binary.
Because if you imagine sort of the 100 solar masses that are accreting, if you imagine that they wouldn't have one single angular momentum or rotation vector, if it changes as a function of radius of what's accreting, you'd always go through a transient type of disk. And so you always have much less mass in the disk. Have you thought about the implications that that has on the MRI and the way it blows out along the poles?
No, I think that's certainly an excellent point, that if the you had substantial variations, then that could make a difference. In my recollection, well, from your simulation, you probably have a quantitative assessment of that. The at least from the results which you published, already showed that the structures that were forming on the smaller scales were somewhat flattened, which suggested that, at least on the large scale, there was sort of an overall angular momentum.
Final questions concerning your last point here. So don't you think that in fact, the even if you have this early pre-enrichment by fairing stability supernovae, they are in the range that you are suggesting, and you think that by the time in which you see stars in our halo, their nuclear synthetic signature has been erased by a number of other stars, at least in the intergalactic medium, I say. Because you continue to build up top two stars and they will erase any signature of the first one.
Well, no, I guess I'm saying that if you, as soon as you get to this limit where you can form the very first low mass stars, then if the metallicity has been set by the pop three stars.
It's very low, right? It's just minus five. So all the stars that come after that, they will inject their metals on top of them. So they will erase every signature.
So I think that you have to find the oldest low mass star. If you imagine that you have this very first generation of supernovae, just setting out some distribution of metals, then when I cross this threshold where the metallicity is high enough to form the pop two stars, then you will get a change. I say. One of the things perhaps which you're driving at is it might be that, although I haven't been sufficiently clear here, if we want, just for purpose of definition, perhaps we could define pop three stars as those which form when the metallicity is so low that the genes mass is hundreds of solar masses and not more like a water solar mass. However, it's possible that some of those pop three stars were not first generation. That is, the pop three may already have several generations. And it's true that what I've been talking about here is just the first generation of the pop three, so I agree with you.
What metallicity would that transition that you just mentioned?
I think it's 10 minus 3 solar, but I think
Well, if you compare, well, it could be less than that, but we can think well,
you're going to discuss this.
In 10 minus 3, what happens is the cooling between metals compete with the cooling between H2.
You're going to discuss it. It's just a relevant number.
Sure, right? Exactly.
But the metals would also be carried not just by supernova, because then you basically enrich it too much. I mean, supernova carries so many metals that you obviously raise the metallicity way above the threshold. But you can perhaps even if you have low mass loss due to winds, that would, and there is nucleosynthesis within the star, that could enrich the environment before it.
There was negative gas as well, which increases that much. But we had a talk of that
Okay.
So we move to the next talk and goodbye.
Oops.
The title is
Are you two?
Yeah,
No, that's one. Do you want just plug in two?